And that was a prejudice that I really had to work on early on because I had a lot of religious intolerance. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of this program. And that's true. It's generic, really. It's spiritual. It's non-denominational. It shouldn't bother anybody with any type of religious affiliation or spiritual belief, because it's all just basic spiritual truth. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. And that squiggly font tells us that that's important. Okay, we're going to start tonight. We did steps 6 and 7 last week. And that came after an inventory and sharing that inventory with a sponsor, a spiritual advisor. We came to a place where we were willing to have God remove the roadblocks in front of our happiness. We identified and discussed the problems in our lives and the things that were keeping us unhappy, the things that were causing us our misery. Sometimes we, maybe until that moment in time, we didn't realize that we were causing our own problems. But after a good fourth step and a good fifth step, you should come to a place where you recognize that you are your own problem. You're causing most, if not all, of your problems in your life. So we become willing to have those defects removed. And if anybody in here is like me, it talks about self-will cannot get rid of self-will. So every character defect I have is basically derived from me running my life on self-will. So if I can't get rid of self-will, I can't get rid of my defects, conversely. They're bigger than me, and I need help with them. Now, I don't want to give the misconception that there's not cooperation that's needed. There's an enormous amount of cooperation needed for you to be able to have your character defects removed with God's help. You have to put yourself in the right spiritual atmosphere. And I'll tell you what, in my own personal experience, there is absolutely no spiritual atmosphere that's better for me to be in, for God to be able to work through me to rid me of my character defects, than to be in amends. It's the next logical step. In other words, if you're out there making amends for the problem self-will has caused, that's going to put you in the best possible atmosphere to have the work done for your self-will character defects. And again, if you're anything like me, you're going to hate doing amends. I hate making amends. And the more amends I make, the more I'm going to cooperate in the removal of my character defects, because I don't want to keep my behavior to continue to harm others, so that I have to keep making these friggin' amends. So they're horrific for me. Some of them, you know, it's very, very difficult for me. I've got an ego that does not want me to do amends. And I understand today that if I don't do amends, I can be led back to alcohol. So I do them, but I'm not happy about them, you know, a lot of times. So step 7, I believe, is putting myself in the best possible atmosphere, the best possible attitude toward the removal of my character defects. And then I move on to step 8. And we're going to start on paragraph 76, page 76, paragraph 3. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. Take those out and pass them around. I explained when we were doing the 4-column inventory that during the inventory, when you see where you were selfish, where you were dishonest, where you were self-seeking, and where you were frightened, if those character defects caused harm, if you look at your part in it and it caused harm to another person, you were to mark it with an A on the side of the fourth column. The same thing with the fear inventory. If you're looking at some of your fears, and some of your fears caused harm, caused your family, friends, loved ones harm, you're to put an A beside that. Also, in the sex inventory, where it asks you, where were you dishonest? Did you unjustifiably arouse resentment, jealousy, and self-pity? All those questions that the sex inventory asks. If there's anywhere that you ask yes, especially to the question, whom did we hurt, you're to mark an A against that also. Now, when we do our list, I'm passing around some sheets of paper here. In it, you'll find an example of an amends card. I found it very, very helpful to do amends on 3x5 or 5x7 index cards. And this will give you an example of that. Are we running out of paper? So what we basically do is we transfer the information that we found from our inventory over onto the index cards. How I like to do this is I like to put the person's name at the top of the card, and if there's resistance to making amends, in other words, if you were to go to this person, place, or institution, and they were to tell you what you need to do to set right the wrong, is there resistance? Put a minus on the top right-hand corner of the card. If you're absolutely willing at this point in time to go make that amend, whatever it might be, put a plus. Put down the person's name. Put down the harms that you're clear on. What you did. Write down how you can get in touch with the person. You know, where are they? Do you need to find them? If you need to find them, put find. If you know where they are, put their address and or phone number. You need all this information. Did I miss anything? No. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we're to go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. Remember, an amend is repairing the damage done in the past. It's not an apology. I suppose an apology can be part of an amend, but that's not the spirit of the amend. The spirit of the amend basically is go to the person and find out what you need to do to set right the wrong. I mean, if it's money owed, then you pay the money back. Whatever you need to do. We attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths over victory for alcohol. And remember, that basically, we came to that conclusion in the first and third step, that we need to be willing to go to any lengths. And those cards that have minuses, like I'm not going to make amends to that son of a bitch, you know, I hate that, you know, I'm not ready for that. You're asked in the A step to pray for the willingness. So whatever stack of cards you have minuses, those are the people you need to pray for the willingness to be able to go make the amends. Now, it says probably there are still some misgivings. If you're anything like me, there's going to be misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured. To some people, we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. That says first approach. That means there may be further approaches. I like to break the amends down into two parts. One of them is the approach. Let's say you owe $50,000 and you're working at Burger King. Does that mean that you have to wait until you get $50,000 to start amends? No, it doesn't. You make the approach. You go to the person. I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but you go to the person, you make the approach. And what the approach is, basically, is it's making the deal. And then whatever the deal is, you follow through on that. When that's followed through with, the amend is complete. But we can take care of the approaches rather quickly. The alcoholics are egomaniacs. If they owe $50,000, they don't want to see the person until they have 50 grand in their pocket and they can throw it down on the table, you know? It's humbling to go to somebody and say, I can send you $5 a week. But it's a good kind of humbling. You know what I mean? Under no circumstances do we criticize such a person or argue. Oh, I'm sorry. Up the top of the page. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we're trying to put our lives in order. But this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and those people about us. It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from injustice to him and announce that we have gone religious. In the prize ring, this would be called leading with the chin. We may lay ourselves open to be branded fanatics or religious bores. You know, keep the spiritual stuff to a minimum just so that they don't think we're whack jobs. Because I'll tell you, I have made amends to people, and later on down the road, because of the amends that I made, I've been in a unique situation to be helpful to such people. I've known so many people who've gone out and made amends, and then the person who they made amends to, son's in trouble with drugs or booze. Mm. Guess who gets a call? You know, so we don't want to do anything that would stop that channel from being open. We want to be very careful with our amends to not sound fanatical. You know what I mean? We need to be very clear, and it'll tell us how to be very clear. We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message, but our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. They're not going to be real interested in, oh, I'm in AA, and I'm going to all these great meetings, and, you know, I'm going to speak next Thursday at the men's stag meeting. And they're not going to give a damn about that. They want their money back. You know what I mean? And it's their money. It's not, we like to think, I've got to give them my money. It's not our money, it's their money, and they just want it back. You know what I mean? So anyway, he's going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than in our talk of spiritual discoveries. That's absolutely true. We don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God. When it will serve any good purpose, we are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. If there's a reason to bring up that you've found God, then go ahead, please, and bring it up. But the question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. All right, they're going to give us different types of amends. They're going to give us instructions on different types of amends. This is how you make amends to the people on your resentment list. You want to get rid of resentments real quick? You know, go make amends to the people that you resent. And these are the people we hate. And whenever you hear somebody, I like Gary's example, whenever you hear somebody who went back and made amends to somebody they couldn't stand, it was incredibly beneficial. Ron's example is unbelievable too. And I've never seen it fail. It's like, it's unbelievable. The more you hate the person, the better the amend is going to be for you. It's something you can't figure out going in, but I'll tell you, it's true. And I've seen it so many times. Anyway, this is what we do with the person we hate. It may be that he has done us more harm than we have done him, and though we may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. That means you're not going to want to do it, but you force yourself to go do it. It's hard to do. You pray like a bastard. You tell your sponsor and all your buddies you're going to go do it, so now you got to go do it to, you know, and you just go do it. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find that it's much more beneficial to us. That's an absolutely true. And a promise. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply, we tell him that we will never get over drinking until we've done our utmost to straighten out the past. That's what you're supposed to tell the person that you hate. You're supposed to tell him, I will never get over drinking unless I do the best job I can to straighten out all my past relationships. You know, that's why I'm here. I want to just jump back a little bit into our prehistory. Before Frank Buckman started the Oxford Group, which is where Alcoholics Anonymous came from, he was a minister out in Pennsylvania. He was in the Allentown area. And he was running a hospice for some boys, which was a big thing back around the turn of the century, these hospices. And what happened was he had a board of directors of five ministers who were on the board of directors who didn't see things his way, okay? They had other ideas for how this place should be run. And he quit in a huff with a giant resentment against these five board of directors people, and he ended up over in England or something doing some kind of religious thing. But he was haunted with this. Resentment was eating him away. And he got the inspiration to write those five people letters of apology, confessing his former ill feeling and expressing his regret. And he mailed them off. And he felt such a spiritual relief from mailing those letters off that it led him into forming the Oxford Group. the spiritual experience to be got from the direct amends or indirect amends through the mail was enough for him to have a spiritual awakening that he started to base the whole idea of the Asher group on. So I say again that if you have a deep resentment against somebody, really look at making an amends to them if you want to be free. I mean, do you want to be free or do you want to be right? You know? I'm shooting for freedom today because it's in my best interest.
Chris, can I interrupt just one second?
Sure.
Question? But in some cases, for example, if what you did was sort of, there's a lot of character assassination, which is sort of my background. In other words, you talk really badly about people. You do a lot more, you know, you do more harm by calling up and saying, listen, you never knew this, but I said all these horrible things about you.
I would keep it general. It says we confess our former ill feeling. You know, we don't have to go into particulars. And if it would harm the person to say, I scumbagged you from New Jersey to Connecticut, you know, to everybody I know, you know, you don't say that. You just, you know, I was wrong. I had bad feelings toward you. I've actually had to do this to people in AA because I've scumbagged AA people. And then I went through the inventory and go, oh no, I gotta go make amends to that jerk. And I've had to do that. And believe me, you do get free, and you don't scumbag him again because you know you don't want to go back and have to make another amends. So it works, it really does. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so, never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is frank, calm, and open, we will be gratified with the result. That's another promise. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we're calling upon admits his own fault, so feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. I've really only had a couple of amends where the person refused to see me. I had a boss that on 2 approaches, he refused to see me. And it was, I had about 1.5 years on the first approach. I had about 3.5 years on the second approach. And I finally had about 6.5, 7 years on the last approach, and he finally would talk to me. And I was able to sit down with him and make amends to him. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we're doing and wish us well. 9 times out of 10, when you ask, what can I do to set right the wrong? They'll say, just keep doing what you're doing. God, you know, that's great. You know, stay sober. And that'll be how you do the amends to the person. It's amazing. You know, you go into it thinking that they're going to ask you to paint their house. I mean, we've got these preconceived notions of how horrible these amends are going to be. And 9 cases out of 10 turn out to be great. You know, and you look at anybody in here who's done a bunch of amends, and they'll agree with me. Occasionally, they will offer assistance. T knows about that. He got offered about 6 jobs, making amends to all his old bosses. Every one of them offered him a job. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office. We've made our demonstration, done our part. It's water over the dam. Here's how we do our financials. Most alcoholics owe money. We do not dodge our creditors, telling them what we're trying to do. We make no bones about our drinking. They usually know about it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory that it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know that we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink if we're afraid to face them. Nothing eats us up more than to owe people money. It's better to pay $5 a week than to avoid these people. You know, we need to at least start doing something with our creditors. Whatever we can do. It doesn't say too many times in the big book that we're liable to drink, or we're quite sure to drink, but there's a couple places where it does. And avoiding financial creditors is one of them. So pay attention. Perhaps we've committed a criminal offense. This is how we do the crime ones. Okay? And there are people in these rooms who've gone back and done B&E amends. I mean, this is you know, how free do you want to be? How much do you want to recover? And this is how we do the crime ones. Perhaps we have committed a criminal offense which might land us in jail if it were known to the authorities. We may be short in our accounts and unable to make good. We have already admitted this in confidence to another person, but we're sure we would be imprisoned or lose our job if it were known. Maybe it's only a petty offense such as padding the expense account. Most of us have done that sort of thing. Maybe we are divorced and have remarried but haven't kept up the alimony to number one. She's indignant about it and has a warrant out for our arrest. That's a common form of trouble too. Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. These are the guiding principles for criminal amends. Reminding ourselves that we've decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience, we ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything. I'll also say that I have never once in my entire life seen somebody go to jail for making an amends. One of my favorite speakers talks about a guy in California. He was from South Central Los Angeles, and he was trouble. And he got sober, and he had over 350 amends to do on his amends list, and 250 of them were breaking and entering amends. He ripped off 250 homes. He went back to every single place he could remember and knocked on the door and made direct amends, and he did not go to jail. All right? So we have to be willing to go to jail. I've never seen anybody go to jail. Usually, however, other people are involved. Therefore, we are not to be the hasty and foolish martyr who would needlessly sacrifice others to save himself from the alcoholic pit. This is the important part. There are so many ways that you can harm others to do amends. I'll just give one of my last amends was, it came to me after years and years and years, that back in the late 70s, I rented a house with a couple of other guys, and we were thrown out of there for loud parties. And before we left, we trashed the house. I mean, we trashed this house. We ripped the doors off the hinges and made a bonfire in the backyard. We kicked in all the sheetrock and put chicken parts behind all the cabinets and then moved out a month early. I mean, we trashed this place. It was unlivable after we got done with it. And I didn't remember. I didn't even think about it my first couple of inventories, but it came to me during my last inventory. I said, I gotta do something about this now that I remembered it, for God's sake. So I got a hold of the roommate that I could still get a hold of, and I told him what I was going to do. I'm going to try to find these people. Is that all right with him? And he goes, yeah, just don't mention my name. So I sought his permission, and I tried to find them. Their names were Shaws, and they lived in Tampa, and that's all I could remember. I ended up calling something like 140 Shaws in Tampa, Florida, trying to track down the family that owned this house, this property, and I couldn't do it. I figure it's about $2,000 worth of damage at that time that I did. So I need to put that money back into society somehow. I can't get it to the Shaws. They were elderly at that time. They're probably dead. But what I can do is I can move the money out into society somehow. You know, and that's what I'm doing. A man we know had remarried. Because of resentment and drinking, he had not paid alimony to his first wife. She was furious. She went to court and got an order for his arrest. He had commenced our way of life, had secured a position, and was getting his head above water. It would have been impressive heroics if he walked up to the judge and said, "Here I am." We thought he ought to be willing to do that if necessary, but if he were in jail, he could provide nothing for either family. We suggested he write his first wife admitting his faults and asking forgiveness. He did, and also sent a small amount of money. He told her what he would try to do in the future. He said he was perfectly willing to go to jail if she insisted. Of course she did not, and the whole situation has long since been adjusted. Okay, here's an important one. Before taking drastic action which might implicate other people, we secure their consent, like I did with my ex-roommate. If we have obtained permission, have consulted with others, and asked God to help, and the drastic step is indicated, we must not shrink. You know, this is how we prepare for it. Right, Rich? That's right. This brings to mind a story about one of our friends. While drinking, he accepted a sum of money from a bitterly hated business rival, giving him no receipt for it. He subsequently denied having received the money and used the incident as a basis for discrediting the man. He thus used his own wrongdoing as a means of destroying the reputation of another. In fact, his rival was ruined. He felt that he had done a wrong he could not possibly make right. If he opened that old affair, he was afraid it would destroy the reputation of his partner, disgrace his family, and take away his means of livelihood. What right had he to involve those dependent upon him? How could he possibly make a public statement exonerating his rival? This really is important, too. If you're about to sell your house to pay off an amends, you better be consulting with your spouse and family. You know, it's really not right to involve them negatively in these things, you know. After consulting with his wife and partner, he came to the conclusion that it was better to take those risks than to stand before his Creator guilty of such ruinous slander. He saw that he had to place the outcome in God's hands, or he would soon start drinking again and all would be lost anyhow. Mm. Let's take that sentence and let's consider for a minute if that could be our case. Everybody ask yourself, could it be true that each and every amend I have to do can be contingent on whether or not I drink alcohol again? You know? Could it be? Is that possible that every amends you have can be directly related to whether you pick up a drink? Also, I like where it says, put the outcome in God's hands. Just go in and do the amends and have faith that God's not going to throw your ass in jail. You know what I mean? Or God's not going to allow you to have too hard terms for you to be able to deal with. He attended church for the first time in many years. After the sermon, he quietly got up and made an explanation. His action met widespread approval, and today he's one of the most trusted citizens of his town. This all happened years ago. The chances are that we have domestic troubles. Here's how you do domestic troubles. Perhaps we're mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people, but drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely, sorry for self. He commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he's having a secret and exciting affair with a girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who's literally gone through hell for him. Whatever the situation, we usually have to do something about it. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? Not always, we think. I mean, you do not want to go up to your spouse and say, honey, I've slept with all the neighbors adjoining our property and the milkman. I got to get this off my chest because I feel terrible about it. Boy, do I feel better. You know? Because this is going to cause an immense amount of pain in the person that we're making amends to. We're not about making amends to other people and harming them. That's not what we're about. The people I see who go off half-cocked, they do step one and step nine. You know, those people usually, if they do the program right in the future, they have to make amends for the way they made amends later on. You know what I mean? If she knows in a general way that we've been wild, should we tell her in detail? Undoubtedly, we should admit our fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She will want to know who the woman is and where she is. We feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. We are sorry for what we have done. God willing, it shall not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do, for we have no right to go further. Though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found that this is the best course to take. I'll tell you, though, if you're going to admit to infidelity with a spouse, you better be prepared for having that come back up and slap you in the face of every goddamn argument you have for the next 30 years. You know what I mean? Because that's very possible that can happen. So be very careful about how you explain it. Our design for living is not a one-way street. It is good for the wife as it is for the husband. If we can forget, so can she. It is better, however, that one does not needlessly name a person upon whom she can vent jealousy. Perhaps there are some cases where the utmost frankness is demanded. No outsider can appraise such an intimate situation. It may be that both will decide that the way of good sense and loving kindness is to let bygones be bygones. Each might pray about it, having the other one's happiness uppermost in mind. And remember, the families were involved in this 12-step process back then when this book was written. The families were doing the prayer and meditation. The families were going to the meetings. Keep it always in sight that we're dealing with that most terrible human emotion, jealousy. good generalship may decide that the problem be attacked on the flank rather than risk a face-to-face combat. What that said for people who are slow is don't get involved in details. You know? Be very, very general. If we have no such complication, there's plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs do is to keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't, but he's yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents whom for years he has so shockingly treated, passing all understanding as the patients mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. I just want to say right now that before you go and make amends to your family, read the chapter to wives. If you're one of these alcoholics, and believe me, we're in a cloud toward how bad we really are a lot of times when we come in here, the chapter to wives gives and breaks down in detail about 100 different things that we do that wives have to put up with. You know, read that chapter and ask yourself the question, you know, did I do this? Am I guilty of this? Before you you fill out your amends card completely with all the wrongs you're clear on. Had this not been so, many of us would have had no homes today and would perhaps be dead. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead, affections have been uprooted, selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He is like the farmer who came up out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?" Yes, there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. So we're the ones who are to take the lead to try to put our families back together again. Okay? We're the ones that have to start being an example to everybody. A remorseful mumbling that we're sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. Try doing that for a month, not criticizing anybody in your family. Do it, start tonight, and do it as a spiritual exercise. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. These are prayer directives. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. That's the only way you can 12-step a family member, I think, is with your behavior. Become a changed person for the better, and they'll get curious. Go up to them and tell them that they should do this, they should do that, and they should do this, and you're going to build a wall. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. Here are the ones that we can't right. There's different reasons for why we can't right something, you know. Someone might have died. Someone might have disappeared. You don't know where they are. There's just many, many things. I worked through the steps with a guy who started a brokerage firm. He was hot on Wall Street. Man, he was the golden boy. And he took people's money from right and left. Everybody was investing $1 million with this guy. And he invested in a couple of Canadian auto places that he thought were going to do well. And they all bankrupted. He completely wiped out these mutual fund things that he had started. He signed personally for them. He guaranteed them with his personal signature. So is this guy, he just got a job after about a year being unemployed. How is this guy going to pay back like $10 million? You know what I mean? He's not going to be able to. So there are things that you can do, though. We don't. He's not going to be able to. So there are things that you can do, though. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would write him if we could. If he had $10 million, he'd pay the guys back. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter, and there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. The rule generally is if you can't see somebody, you send a letter. In some cases where the person is still smarting from my injustice and is just, it's just going to be explosive, I'll send a letter asking that, you know, letting the person know that I'm going to try to make an approach. You know, sometimes I'll send a letter like that. And I do letters with the people that are dead. I just did one with my father a couple of weeks ago. He's been dead 30 years now. And in all my previous inventories, I came to the conclusion that he died when I had just turned 12. So there's nothing to make amends for. I was an 11-year-old kid, for God's sake. What could I have done? Well, I treated his family like shit for the next 30 years. He wasn't around to be able to do anything about it. That's what I needed to make amends for, and that's what I made amends for this past time. Anyway, we should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. You know, we don't snivel up to make amends. We walk up, you know, proud and confident, hopefully. If we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we're halfway through. Here are the 9-step promises. I'm going to read them. So many people call them the 12 promises of AA, and I think that's very, very misleading because there's promises from the title page on. There's, at last count, 274 promises in the big book, you know, one person's interpretation at least. So there's a million. These are the 9-step promises, and they can be taken out of context when they're put up on the walls of the rooms. They manifest themselves after you're firmly underway with your amends. These things happen. And you can ask anybody who's really attacked an amends list whether these promises have come true, and there's not one person I've ever met that didn't say, you're damn right these came true. You know what I mean? And these are the 9-step promises. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. That's a great one. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. The economic insecurity may not leave you, but the fear of it will. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, sometimes as quickly as you do the 9th step. They will always materialize if we work for them. What a great promise that is. That's right. If. Tonight we're going over steps 10 and 11. And in the preceding 15 weeks, it's taken us really to go through the big book to get up to this point. And I think steps 10 and 11 are very, very good steps for us to pay attention to. I believe that step 10 is basically a combination of all the preceding steps, and step 11 really lets us grow spiritually and really lets us grow emotionally when we practice it the way it's laid out in the big book. I just want to read a couple of sentences from the foreword before I start. This is the very first thing that you read in the big book. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So we've gone over a lot of the action steps so far, and they're really designed to recover us from alcoholism. It's really a true statement to say that you cannot think your way into sobriety. Self-knowledge alone is not going to do it. There's certain actions that we have to take, certain spiritual exercises that we have to take to be able to really recover spiritually and mentally and emotionally from alcoholism. You know, drinking is really just a symptom of alcoholism. There's an underlying cause to why we're so screwed up that we have to always be out of our mind drunk or on drugs or something. That underlying cause is really what needs treatment. And to just sit in an AA meeting and expect to recover from alcoholism is short-sighted at best. a lot of times you can achieve periods of sobriety, but that underlying unrest, that underlying uneasiness and uncomfortability is going to still continue. So that thought really brings us to step 10. I'm going to start reading on page 84, paragraph 2. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. So that's steps 4 and steps 9. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit. What a great statement that is, you know. One of the instructions earlier in the big book is whenever you see a spiritual term, ask yourself what it means to you. You know, so I'm supposed to ask myself, what does it mean to enter the world of the Spirit? Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. So I believe part of step 10, and certainly part of step 11, is a growth step to help us grow spiritually. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. That's step 7. We discuss them with somebody immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. That's step 5. And step 9. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. That's step 12. Love and tolerance of others is our code. That's a tough code, I'll tell you. So if you're anything like me, my first year or two of sobriety, love and tolerance was anything but my code. I wanted to kill everybody. So, yeah, I was mad at 90% of the people in the meetings, and then after like 6 months, it was 80%, you know, and then after a year, it was like down to 70%. It was slow going. And we've ceased. Here are the 10-step promises. You know, we go to a lot of meetings where the topic of the meeting is the 12 promises of AA. Basically, they're the 9-step promises. But check out some of these 10-step promises. And I totally believe that if you do the step preceding, if you do all the work up to paragraph 84.3, if you've done all the exercises that they lay out for you, by the time you get to paragraph 84.3, these are some of the promises that are going to have manifested themselves in you. And we've ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. You know, that's a highlight there for some of us. You know, we're actually sane now. That's a plus. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. And step 10 really is how you keep in fit spiritual condition. You continue to practice the steps in your life. But I like how they describe how the alcohol problem is going to be removed. I fought alcohol like you wouldn't believe, and it was a battle. I had my ass kicked. You know what I mean? Time and again, I swore it off and ended up drunk out of my mind. But I found, truly, just like this book says, that once I had taken inventory, once I'd done a fifth step, once I'd written out my amends and gone out and made the amends to the best of my ability, and started to do this stuff as a way of life, as a way of living, I found that alcohol really wasn't a problem for me anymore. When I do think about it, I think about it as if, you know, I definitely can't drink that stuff. And you see, people that relapse, they are not restored to sanity. They still think they're suffering from the delusion that somehow, someday, or some way, they can drink again normally, or they can drink without consequences or whatever. And those are the people who have not been restored to sanity. So if you really look at this and you really believe what it says, you are not safe and protected from alcohol until you are through your amends. You know what I mean? You're rolling the dice every day until you finish the spiritual process of steps 4 through 9, if what this book says is true. So that's another motivator to do your amends. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. Where's T? What are laurels, T? There you go. We're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We're not cured of alcoholism. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. So we maintain our spiritual condition, and we are given a daily reprieve by God so that we don't have to pick up or use. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. How can I best serve thee? That thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts that must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. So they're giving us, they told us earlier in the book that willpower is no use at all against alcohol. You can't just decide not to drink and not drink. If that's true, if you can just decide to not drink and not drink, then you're not alcoholic. You have power over alcohol. You can drink or not drink. You can take it or leave it alone. That's not the type of person that fills up these rooms. The type of people that end up in these rooms are people who have tried to stop drinking and have found they can't. You know what I mean? So the proper use of the will, I believe, is using your willpower to do the steps, using your willpower to go to meetings, and using your willpower to be of service where it's available and appropriate. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, if we've taken the instructions in the book up to this point, we've begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. To some extent, we've become God conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. But we must go further, and that means more action. They're always doing that to us. They're always saying, you know, we got more work for you, pal. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. This is called retiring at night. And I always wondered why they put the retiring at night before the upon awakening. You know, those are two separate 11-step exercises that we're supposed to follow every day. Why did they put the at night? And then I came to realize that after you're done reading this, it's not going to be the morning, it's going to be the night. In other words, once you've gone through these instructions and read it, it's most likely sometime during the day, and your next step is to do the at night part of it. The Oxford group really is where we developed a lot of the things that we do to recover from alcoholism. And they were really big on prayer and meditation. It was very important. And in early AA, around the Akron area, that was a hotbed for Oxford group activity. Dr. Bob has said in print that meetings were desirable and prayer and meditation were essential for recovery from alcoholism. So that shows how important they really believed it was. Everybody had a quiet time in the morning. And everybody prayed and meditated like maniacs in those days. And, you know, that was just how they did it. So this is retiring at night. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Basically, what the retiring at night is we look over how well we were able to work the 10th step. How were we able to maintain the discipline of working the steps in our life? Did we do a good job with it? Did we fall short? These are the things that we're supposed to look at. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, and afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Or were we thinking of what we could do for others? Of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. In other words, the 11-step evening exercise really isn't designed to beat us up. We're just supposed to constructively look over our day. And if we've fallen short, we're supposed to take action to set it right. Like if we've lost our shit and gone crazy at work or something, we're supposed to review it and plan on going in tomorrow and making an amends. You know what I mean? These are the things that we have to do to keep from getting in an emotional state that's dangerous for us. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. I might just take one of these and pass them around. I have some pamphlets here that basically they take some of the statements in step 10 and 11 and they turn them into questions. And I think it's just kind of like a good exercise to ask ourselves, are we doing these? Are we falling short on this part of our program? So that's the retiring at night. Here's the upon awakening. This is what we're supposed to do first thing in the morning. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Remember, we've been restored to sanity. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought, or decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We are often surprised how right answers come after we've tried this for a while. One of the great misconceptions I had when I first came into AA was I thought that meditation was sitting in a lotus position, burning incense, and chanting a monosyllable for 2 hours straight. You know, emptying your mind, like that's something that I could do. I could empty my mind. I got a committee in my head. You know what I mean? I'm not going to be emptying that baby real quick. Basically, what they were talking about with meditation back in the 30s when they wrote this was they were using the exercise which was known as biblical meditation. You would read a section of spiritual literature. Most of the times they would read the Bible, but a lot of times it was Oxford Group literature. And you would think deeply about a certain topic. Try to concentrate on one topic and think deeply about it. And they would do that. Another Oxford Group practice was asking for guidance from God. And how they would do that is they would say, you know, how am I going to handle that meeting at work today? And you would get quiet and you would ask God for an intuitive thought. And a thought would come to you. And if you would have to check it against the four absolutes, the absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute love, and absolute, purity. You measure the decision or the intuitive thought against those four absolutes, and if it measured up against the absolutes, that was your decision. They believed that came from God, and you were to follow that. You know, so this is what they used. It doesn't explain it explicitly in this, but that's what they were doing at the time. What used to be a hunch or an occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. So if we practice this asking for an intuitive thoughts, we may develop an ability to go into our intuition or to go into our conscience or go into our spirit selves or whatever you want to call it and allow the God aspect of our nature to make a decision rather than the ego. You know, there's always the duality that we have. Our ego is always fighting our spirit self. So we're told to practice this, asking for guidance in meditation. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we're going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. I think I'll go to Tijuana and manage a female mud wrestling team. Yeah, you know, this is something you better run by your sponsor. they did check a lot of this guidance, you know, with each other. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. You know, like I'd like $1 million and if I get $1 million, I'll lend some to Carl. You know, that's legal. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. Mm-hmm. The only prayers I ever had when I was out there was, please don't let the cop turn on his lights behind me, for God's sake. I will go back to church. You know? I'll feed the lepers. Just don't let them turn on the lights. And I'll tell you what, he always turned on the lights. It never worked. Here is the lost paragraph of the Big Book. They call this the lost paragraph of the Big Book. The Oxford Group people were very family-oriented. They got the wife, grandparents, kids. They got them down at the kitchen table, and they did the morning prayer meditation together. This is it's kind of like a lost art in AA. If circumstances warrant, we ask our friends and wives to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we've been discussing. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. We be quick to see where religious people are right and make use of what they have to offer. Just from my own personal experience, and this is not AA, it's just my own personal experience, I understand why he put priest, minister, and rabbi in here. I went through a period of time where I went to all the New Age bookstores. I just grabbed everything that I could off the shelf, spiritual healing through crystals. Put a pyramid over your bed and become wealthy. I mean, all these crazy books. I mean, I was whacked out in early sobriety. And I found so much stuff was hollow. So much stuff was hollow. But there is a body of Christian and religious writings that are tried and true spiritual classics. And if you go to a priest, minister, or rabbi, they will give them to you, and it won't be like the latest self-help craze. You know what I mean? Like heal your wounded inner child and recover from alcoholism or some crap like that. You know? So I understand why they put that in there. And for my own, I'm not trying to knock anything. You know, God forbid I judge anything anybody's reading. But far be it from me. But just personally, I found that the classics, the tried and true stuff is really, really good. Anyway, as we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. So let's say you get pissed off. What are you supposed to do? You're supposed to pause. You're not supposed to kill them. You're supposed to pause and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, "Thy will be done." We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. And those are not things that you want to have hanging around you all the time. So follow this suggestion and you will grow. We become much more efficient. That's a plus. I found that I accomplished more at work when I worked smart than when I worked hard, We do not tire so easily, for we're not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. At work, it really does. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple way that we have just outlined. But that is not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. It's taken us 15 weeks to get to the point where we're finally on chapter 7, working with others. And just before I start reading working with others, I want to talk about something just for a minute. I was just poking through Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age. Basically, it's a history book that talks more or less about how we came to be and how our central office and general service came into being. And like the last two-thirds of the book are basically on Alcoholics Anonymous' three legacies. And this is something that I don't think you can hear too much about, because it's very, very important. It's very, very important to understand the legacies. Some people who have older books, you'll see the circle and the triangle. Now, about 2 years ago or so, they stopped printing the circle and the triangle on conference-approved literature. That had to do with some people were mistaking us for Hazleton, or, you know, so there was some type of controversy like that. And Alcoholics Anonymous does not fight nor sue or anything like that. So I believe that they just decided to drop the logo rather than be mistakenly confused with the Hazleton organization.
Is it still the official logo?
We've dropped it.
Oh, it's no longer in use.
Yeah, we've dropped it from our conference of religion, and it's really a shame. It's really a shame. Anyway, the circle and the triangle basically represents the three legacies of service, and it's an equilateral triangle. That means that each of the three legacies is equally important. Now, we have the legacy of recovery. That is basically the 12 steps as they're outlined in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And the recovery process is basically taking those steps and those instructions from the big book. Then you have the legacy of unity. Unity is basically the meetings and how we get together and how we congregate, you know. And the third legacy is service. And service is basically my interpretation of service is anything that helps the message be carried. Some of the general service people want you to believe that that's the only type of service work there is, but I certainly don't believe that. I believe everything from making coffee, taking people to meetings, anything like that is service. Probably the best part of service is taking somebody through the 12 steps. As it states in our 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. Basically, in the early days of AA, they would take you into recovery before they would take you into the unity aspect. In other words, you were not brought to the meetings until you were very, very far along on your steps. This is in the first years of AA. If you weren't on amends, they didn't believe that you had a serious or honest desire to stop drinking, and they wouldn't mess around with you. So you'd go through recovery, then you'd go to meetings, you'd get together with the fellowship, and then you'd move out into service. Today it's different. Today, the first thing that happens in AA is you go to meetings. Hopefully the second thing that will happen is you'll get involved in the recovery part, which is working the 12 steps out of the big book. And then the third thing, hopefully, is you'll carry the message of the 12 steps in the big book to other recovering or other still suffering alcoholics. The problem in Alcoholics Anonymous in the course of the last 20 or 30 years is it's gotten a little confused. It's gotten a little muddied. Somewhere along the road, it became all right to not do the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and to just go to meetings, and people would in the meetings would consider you a fine example of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether you did the steps or not, whether you provided service to the still suffering alcoholic or not. Now, that's really what's changed in AA. And as we go through Chapter 7 here, we're going to see some instructions that I believe still should be followed. Each 12-step call, this chapter specifically concerns carrying the message to the still suffering alcoholic, doing 12-step work in that way. I believe that there's still some real valid information in this chapter, and I find when I follow it, there's a better chance of a successful 12-step call than if I don't. I've made practically every mistake you can make doing 12-step work. I've put ladders up against people's houses and broken in to go get them to carry the message. I've done practically everything you can possibly do. I've brought non-alcoholics into AA meetings thinking that they could use some help. I've done it all wrong, and I've learned from my mistakes. But I'll tell you, if you pay attention to Chapter 7, it'll keep you from making mistakes. And Chapter 7 does not say grab the alcoholic and rush him off to a meeting. It does not say grab the alcoholic and rush him off to a rehab. which a lot of people mistakenly confuse the way you deal with drunks these days. It sometimes that's appropriate, but what this chapter tells us really is, tell him about your drinking. If they start telling you about their drinking, shut up and listen. And if you are convinced that they are an alcoholic, lay out the program of recovery, which is the steps. That's what it tells us to do. It does not say rush them off the Happy Hills detox or whatever. Although it does suggest that if somebody needs medical treatment, by all means, that's the best route. But it doesn't say lock them away in Elena Lodge for 27 months. It says take them through the steps. So anyway, with the advent of all the rehabs closing, the insurance companies tightening their belt, and I'm telling you, the 12-step work is going to come back like it used to be. Mm. You know, for a long time, the proliferation of treatment facilities has pulled a lot of the wet drunk work away from us, but I'm telling you, you can't get into these places anymore. I had a case just last weekend where I was trying to find a place for a person, and all the places that I'm used to bringing people have changed their policies. They've lost their Medicaid. They need special insurance. They need assets signed over. And I don't know too many alcoholics and drug addicts that are ready for treatment that have assets to sign over, you know? So I found one place. Carl, my friend here, hooked me up with one place. And it's a grim, grim place. You know, it's a therapeutic community. But it's the only place that I know of today where you can just grab somebody with absolutely no money or no means and drag them down there and they'll take them. You know? So anyway, with the advent of the closing of all these places, AA best be prepared to accept the 12-step work that is going to come our way. Otherwise, a lot of people are going to die. So anyway, I think this is an important chapter, and I'll get started. Chapter 7, page 89. Working with others. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. That is so true. Both Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson were both in the Oxford group desperately wanting to stay away from alcohol, but Bill Wilson was the one staying sober and Dr. Bob wasn't. And Dr. Bob had more time in the Oxford group than Bill Wilson. I believe it was because Bill Wilson was running around bringing drunks home, trying to sober them up. He did a lot of active work with the still suffering alcoholic. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. What is this message? So many people think this message is come on to meetings. What they're talking about in this chapter is carry this message. They've told us that we're alcoholic, we cannot manage our own lives, that God could and would if he were sought, and they gave us the means to seek God. That's the message we're supposed to carry to the still suffering alcoholic. You can help him when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember that they are very ill. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contacts with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. Perhaps you're not acquainted with any drinkers who want to recover. You can easily find some by asking a few doctors, ministers, priests, or hospitals. I'll tell you, you can find people in AA meetings that want to recover. Because I'm certainly not one of these people that think by sitting in an AA meeting you recover from alcoholism any more than by sitting in a garage you'll become a car. You know what I mean? There's some serious change that has to happen for recovery. They will be only too glad to assist you. Don't start out as an evangelist or reformer. Unfortunately, a lot of prejudice exists. You will be handicapped if you arouse it. Ministers and doctors are competent, and you can learn much from them if you wish, but it happens that because of your own drinking experience, you can be uniquely useful to other alcoholics. So cooperate, never criticize, to be helpful is our only aim. And just going back to the Bill and Dr. Bob story that everybody knows so well, A lawyer carried the message of the medical estimate of alcoholism to a doctor. Okay? That's really profound. The doctor himself, even with all of his medical knowledge, really needed to hear the message from another alcoholic, somebody who drank like he did, somebody who really knew the game. You know what I mean? A lot of people tried to talk to me about my drinking, and they were non-alcoholic, and a wall went up real quick. I just couldn't relate to them. You know, but when I got a hold of a counselor who was an alcoholic himself, he saw right through my ass. You know what I mean? And he knew what I was thinking. When you discover a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, find out all you can about him. This is very important. If he does not want to stop drinking, don't waste time trying to persuade him. How many times have I made this mistake, you know? Don't bother with them if they're not ready. You may spoil a later opportunity by being a pain in the ass trying to stop somebody when they're not ready. This advice is given for his family also. They should be patient, realizing they are dealing with a sick person. If there is any indication that he wants to stop, have a good talk with the person most interested in him, usually his wife. Get an idea of his behavior, his problems, his background, the seriousness of his condition, and his religious leanings. You will need this information to put yourself in his place to see how you would like him to approach you if the tables were turned. So information about the person is very, very useful. We're about to do a sales job. You know, a 12-step job really is a sales job. You're to convince the person of their problem, and you're to convince the person of their solution, just like a life insurance agent would. You know what I mean? Sometimes it is wise to wait till he goes on a binge. The family may object to this, but unless he's in a dangerous physical condition, it's better to risk it. The absolute best time to approach an alcoholic is when they're in that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, just following another bender. You know, they've gotten one more DWI, or they've gotten thrown out of the house one more time, or they embarrassed the hell out of themselves at one more party. You know, don't deal with him when he's very drunk unless he's ugly and the family needs your help. So it's telling us here not to bother doing any 12-step work when somebody's really drunk. This is another mistake I made. I did 12-step calls when some drunken idiot would call me up and say, "Hey, come over and talk to me." You know, I'd go over and I'd talk to the guy. They wouldn't even remember me being there the next day. I swear to God, you know. There's several just in the last couple of years were like that. Wait for the end of the spree, or at least a lucid interval. You know, try to get them when they're at least lucid. Then let his family or friend ask him if he wants to quit for good, and if he would go to any extreme to do so. That's a great qualifier. If he says yes, then his attention should be drawn to you as a person who is recovered. That qualifies a lot of the people who aren't serious right out of the ball game. Are you willing to go to any length to get sober? You know, if you get an affirmative to that, your chances of the person having a successful 12-step visit by you is greatly increased. You should be described to him as one of a fellowship who, as part of their own recovery, try to help others, and who will be glad to talk to him if he cares to see you. If he does not want to see you, never force yourself upon him. Never put a ladder up to the third story and break in a window. Neither should the family hysterically plead with him to do anything, nor should they tell him much about you. They should wait till the end of his next drinking bout. You might place this book where he can see it in the interval. Has anybody in here ever woke up and found Alcoholics Anonymous literature laying around? I sure have. You know, is AA for you? A little pamphlet. Here, no specific rule can be given. The family must decide these things, but urge them not to be over-anxious, for that might spoil matters. Usually the family should not try to tell your story. When possible, avoid meeting man through his family. Approach through a doctor or institution is a better bet. If your man needs hospitalization, he should have it, but not forcibly unless he's violent. You know, again, I talked about this earlier in the doctor's opinion, but I'll talk about it again. A lot of people, here's a statistic for you. 15% of alcoholics suffer delirium tremens because their alcoholism has progressed to that point. 15% of the alcoholics that suffer delirium tremens die from them. And what happens is you go into such a high level of anxiety and tension that your main blood vessels coming out of your heart burst like garden hoses. And a lot of us die like that in DTs. Or we get a stroke. Or we get a stroke and that takes us right out. Many, many people die in DTs. So if there's a question about your 12-step prospect needing to be detoxed, get them to a detox. You know, I'm not a huge purveyor of sending people to rehabs, but get them to a detox. I'll tell you what, Somerset Medical Center, right over in Somerville, they will monitor the person's vitals, and they'll know if they need to be on Librium. You know, they won't give you Librium unless you need it, and you'll be miserable as hell detoxing there. But they'll keep you alive. You know what I mean? And, you know, some of the detoxes will Librium you out for 3 or 4 days and you'll feel great and you'll be back 2 weeks later because it wasn't that bad of a deal. You know, I'd rather have somebody suffer like a bastard in detox. When your man is better, the doctor might suggest a visit from you. Though you have talked with the family, leave them out of the first discussion. Under these conditions, your prospect will see he's under no pressure. He will feel that he can deal with you without being nagged by his family. Call on him while he is still jittery. He may be more receptive when depressed. That's absolutely true. See your man alone if possible. Now, a lot of people mistake this for go on a 12-step call alone if possible. That's not what this means. This means when you're over at the person's house, don't do the 12-step call in front of his family. Take him off into a room alone. Always do a 12-step call with somebody. Even in the very, very beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous, they would partner up on 12-step calls. I've had my life threatened on two occasions on 12-step calls. I've had people threaten to kill me. So I had other people with me during those two times, and I'm kind of glad that I did. You know, you never know. On one 12-step call, just recently, we were driving up Route 206 to get this guy to a detox out in Pennsylvania because it was the closest detox it would take the guy. And on Route 206, he decided to open the back door of the car and get out. He decided he wasn't going to go. And we were driving up Route 206. There was three of us in the car with this guy, and I was in the back seat with my seatbelt on, and I was able to grab him and keep him from jumping out of the car. You know, so that's another reason to go with more than one person. You know, you might save the other guy's life. Anyway, at first engage in a general conversation. After a while, turn to talk to some phase of drinking. Tell him about your drinking habits, symptoms, and experiences. And encourage him to speak of himself. I talked about this earlier. If he wishes to talk, let him do so. Let him identify. You will thus get a better idea of how you ought to proceed. If he is not communicative, give him a sketch of your drinking career up to the time you quit, but say nothing for the moment of how that was accomplished. Ooh. That's like a bit you bait him, you know? Well, you want him to say, well, how did you quit? If he's in a serious mood, dwell on the troubles liquor has caused you, being careful not to moralize or lecture. If his mood is light, tell him humorous stories of your escapades. Get him to tell you some of his. It's a sales job. When he sees you know all about the drinking game, commence to describe yourself as an alcoholic. Tell him how baffled you were, how you finally learned that you were sick. Give him account of the struggles you made to stop. Show him the mental twist which leads to the first drink of the spree. We suggest you do this as we have done it in the chapter on alcoholism. If he's an alcoholic, he will understand you at once. He will match your mental inconsistencies with some of his own. They're talking in here about what the Big Book laid out for us. There's a lot of really confusing information going around Alcoholics Anonymous today. I'll pick my favorite. I just don't drink, no matter what. That's a confusing bit of information, because if I've learned anything at all about this, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it tells us that if we're not in a fit spiritual condition, the last thing on our mind is going to be drinking before we pick up a drink. The last thing on our mind. We will decide on a moment's notice that a little bit of whiskey in the milk won't hurt us. Mm. We will decide on a moment's... We will be pounding on the bar asking ourselves how it could have happened again. Mm-hmm. All right? So we need to describe to the 12-step prospect that the mental obsession is beyond human aid and it's beyond willpower. It is something that's very, very subtle.